Today is July 11, 2001. I'm Eleanor Haddon, and I'm interviewing Julia Coburn in Kasan at her home. So I'd like you to first give me your English name, your birth date, and your place of birth.
My name is Julie Rebecca Coburn. I was born August 13, 1921. Born right here in Kasan.
And do you have a Haida name?
I have two Haida names. One is, I think I forgot one of them, but the latest one that was given to me by Florence Davidson of Masset, she gave me the name of Wasal Gidauk, which means a person who hands out the gifts at a potlatch.
Okay. And what's the name of your clan, and what crest do you use?
I'm a Taslanas. I'm a raven, killer whale under the raven, and somewhere there's a brown bear too, I believe.
And could you tell me the meaning of your clan name?
I really can't answer that question. I wouldn't know how to answer it. Excuse me.
Okay. Could you give me the names of your parents and your grandparents?
My mother and father were Lewis and Anna Jones. My grandmother and grandfather were Emma Smith Frank. She married a Frank later after. I'm sort of confused on that.
That's okay.
Her name was Emma Smith, and her husband's name was George Frank.
And how about your father's parents?
My dad's parent, his father was a man stationed at Fort Wrangell, who's a Scotsman, and his mother was Matilda Jones.
Okay. And could you tell me the name of your husband?
My husband is Perry Christian Coburn.
And how about your children and your grandchildren?
My children, our children, Chris Coburn, who passed away, Brian Coburn, Della Coburn, Jean Breinig, and our grandchildren are Marcia and Becky are Brian's, Anna is Della's, Luke and Lee Breinig are Jeannie's children.
Thank you. Do they have Haida names?
Oh, definitely.
And what are they?
Marcia's name is T'auhewat, which is my mother's Haida name, which means copper person. Becky's is T'awadjat, and it has copper ribs, or I'm sorry, I've forgotten
that. Okay.
But they both were named by our father, Lewis Jones.
Okay.
Our son Chris's name was Stas, named after his grandfather. Brian's is Kitkun. Jeannie's is Kais. And Della's is, I've forgotten it, Ilskirai, which means pretty doll.
Hmm. Your grandchildren?
Anna's is, I've forgotten Anna's, I'm sorry, I should have reviewed it.
Kunjat.
Oh yes, Anna's name is Kunjat, which means head lady or executive lady, we prefer to call it. And Luke's is Sea Guy, because Sea Guy was the name of a relative of Luke Frank. And Lee's is Stast, which is my father's name. That a Haida name can be used over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Did you speak or understand Haida when you were growing up?
I didn't speak it, but I understood it perfectly because my parents, my grandparents spoke it.
Did your older brothers and sisters speak it too?
They
understood it.
We all understood it, except for maybe Willard. I don't know, I think Willard does understand it yet. Yes, we all understood it perfectly.
So when in, at home, did you speak Haida or did you speak English?
I always spoke English at home.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. My older sisters and brothers, like Raymond, spoke it perfectly, but I don't know why they didn't expect me. Maybe I was slow or something. I don't know.
So when did Haida stop being spoken at home?
I would say like in the 40s. Mm-hmm. No, my parents always spoke.
Always spoke.
Yeah.
Okay.
Excuse me.
I'd asked you earlier, what places in Kasan or around Kasan, we go down Carter Bay or Grindle or other places in this area, what places are important to you today?
Well, Carter Bay for one, for the sockeye that we get every year without fail, and Grindle for seaweed and gumboots. And there was a time when there was good herring spawn at Sandy Point. That was very special, but it hasn't produced in the last number of years.
When you went up to Carter Bay, did you stay there to camp, or did you just go up and get fish and then come back to Kasan?
I can recall in earlier times, before my dad got the Uranus, we'd go up in a little boat called the Ruth. And it was an open boat. It didn't have a cabin. It must have had an inboard, because I don't remember an outboard. But when we went up to the beach, he just beached it, and we all jumped off, and the men got the sockeye, and then we probably returned to Kasan to process it. But later on, when he got the Uranus, we'd go and stay for several days, 4, 5, 6 days. And there was a smokehouse up there, so Mom would smoke it. And I'm sure we did the canning up there, too. All kind of vague. It's been, you know, like in the 20s and early 30s.
So when you went up to Grindle, you said you went up and got seaweed again. Did you go up for the day or did you stay there?
Oh, no. We stayed for 3 or 4 weeks. They took us out of school. And we lived on the boat. And then later on, Dad built a little house there. And Willard was a baby. And we'd gather seaweed, and my dad would pack fish on the Uranus. I remember a little incident I have to tell you, because my grandmother was so concerned about Willard catching cold, because he was rather sickly. And she came down with rags and corked up all the little holes between the cracks on the floor where the wood had dried up and spread out wider. You know, there she was, pounding on it, getting rid of the draft that came through the cracks on the floor.
So you spent 3 or 4 weeks getting seaweed and fish and gumboots?
Oh, yes.
How did you take care of the seaweed once you picked it?
Oh, that was a fun part of it. We'd pick it, and on a little island we lived on was flat rocks. So we all went out there and spread it very thinly. And of course, we had better weather in those days, it seemed. And after it dried a little more, then we'd turn it over and get the other side dried. And then we had one of those crank food grinders, and we'd grind it that way and then dry it again in the sun for a couple of more days and put it in a 5-gallon coffee can with a lid on it, and that was it, maybe. Also, we did cakes, seaweed cakes, in square boxes. My grandmother would pack it down, mm-hmm. Put a layer of cedar boughs, put a weight on it, put another layer and layer and layer, and by the time she got done, we did that box about so full. And after it formed into squares, then she'd put it out in the sun and dry it for a few more days.
Okay. Now, someone else had talked about seaweed when they roasted on the fire. Did you do that?
I don't recall, but I remember May's grandfather doing that on the beach, getting a big fire going and putting a rack over it, and then drying it. It had a wonderful smoky flavor. I remember that.
And you got gumboots. So how did you preserve those? Or?
Nope. No time to preserve. We ate it. Mom would make a fire on the beach, and we'd put them in a fire and roast and toast them, and eat it on the spot.
How about lady slippers?
Yeah, we did those too, but we were more fond of the gumboots than the lady slippers.
So, so far we have salmon, sockeye, you have seaweed and gumboots. Is there any other food that you used to get from this area?
Venison, mm-hmm. Yeah. And the mom would take it, put it in quart jars and process it that way, or tin cans. And then Dad would smoke a ham, put it in the smokehouse. He'd take and stuff salt and sugar down between where the meat kind of came apart, you know, and hang it directly over the fire and leave it like 3 or 4 days with heavy smoke. And oh, it was wonderful. It turned kind of pinkish. And it was like regular pork ham. Tasty.
Mm. Okay. Did you have, for like vegetables or fruit, what did you do for like berries or a garden? Could you tell me if you had a...
It was our job to go out and pick berries. After I grew older, I had to go out and get a bucket of whatever. And Mama put it in quart jars. And salal berries, jam and jelly. What else? Let me think a minute. Crab apple. And for vegetables, Mom and Dad always had a big garden somewhere. The biggest one I remember was Stevens Ranch, we called it. Mm-hmm. And they put in a huge garden, harvest about 800 or 900 pounds of potatoes.
Wow.
And Mom had a root cellar under the house where she stored it all winter. And she grew enormous heads of cabbage. She'd make a little barrel full of sauerkraut. Lots of carrots, lots of rutabagas, turnips, stuff like that.
So when you went up to put the garden together, did you have a job to do? What was your job?
Hoeing, putting the fertilizer in. I can remember George, my older brother. He's holding his nose up and then taking his herring and putting him in designated spots because it stunk. Good fertilizer.
That's why you got lots of potatoes.
Yes.
So did you, once you planted them, did you just leave it there or did you...
We had to go. I can remember Mom and I rowing from Grindle. We had a rowboat with two pairs of oars. We rowed all the way from Grindle, and we left early in the morning. And when we got here, Southeast kicked up real bad. So instead of bringing the boat to right here by the point, we beached it by the Webb house and walked to the house. And then the next morning early, the wind had passed, so the next morning early, we got back into the skiff and rowed up to Stevens Ranch. She and I hoed all day, hilled it. You know, you have to hill the potatoes. And we knew that the mailboat would be coming by, so he left word here with somebody that we needed a tow back to Grindle, so he towed us back to Grindle. We didn't have to row all the way.
How old was your mom?
She was probably in her 40s, mid-40s. She was still pretty young, you know, strong.
Wow.
And I used to be a pretty good rower.
So, did you pick berries, you did your potatoes. Was there anything else that you used to, say, get in the springtime? Because we, you know, food comes just at certain times. Seaweed came in May.
Oh yeah, we ate a lot of salmonberry sprouts. Just playing out, we'd see a nice pink one and peel it right in the spot and eat it. We also ate Indian celery, but you had to be very careful because you could get burnt from it. We dipped that in sugar, mm-hmm. And the folks were fussy about their. They mix a little sugar with oregano. Then there was another vegetable. Okay. It's a Indian rice, we called it. It's got a purple flower like a bell, and you dig down about 8 or 10 inches, and here's a bulb of rice, huge kernels, very starchy. Mom loved it, so I'd go up by Sunny Hat Creek and get some for her, and she'd cook it, and it was very delightful for her, but I didn't care for it. There was another one called Indian rhubarb. Now Margaret Olson and her gang would go up every spring when they were ready and get it and gather it and eat it, but I don't know, Mom never did go much for Indian rhubarb. It had a name, but I can't remember.
Okay.
If I liked it, I would remember, no doubt.
Now, say like right now, this time of year, in June, July, what kind of, besides salmon berries and fish, is there anything else that you used to go out and harvest?
Like huckleberries,
blueberries. How about from the beach?
Clams of all kinds, and there's rock oysters around here, but I've never been fortunate enough to find one. It has to be like a 4 foot minus. I just heard about it. And once in a while we get a few abalone when we were getting seaweed.
And how about like asparagus or goose tongue? Did you used to go
unheard of until about the 40s, because it was not a native food. It was introduced to us by the people who moved up here from Kent Valley, Washington, and they taught us how to eat goose tongue. And the old lady who was a minister, Mrs. Gilmore, is the one who taught us about asparagus.
Well, did it already grow here? Or
it was already here, but we just didn't know any better. I mean, nobody told us it was good. So there's no name for asparagus or goose tongue.
I didn't know that.
It's something new in the Indian culture, and everybody seems to love it.
So you didn't start eating it until the 40s?
30s. There's goose tongue first, like uh-huh. in the 30s, and the asparagus like in the 40s and 50s. Because I recall we were up at Carta on David Peel's boat, and he was married to that lady, Mrs. Gilmore, who was a minister. And she started telling me about it. She said, it's the most delicious thing you ever tasted. You ought to try it. And I said, well, I don't know what it is. And she says, it grows on a beach by the rocks. And she explained it to me. And I thought, boy, I'm going to find out about it. And one day, Della and I and somebody else were walking on the beach by Sunny Hat, and I saw it, and I thought, oh, this is what she's been talking about. And she told me how to cook it. And boy, that was the beginning right there, probably 52, 51. That's when we learned about it.
Interesting. Ready for a break?
Yes.
Okay.
Start?
Yeah. When you made the seaweed in the box, could you tell me again how you did that?
Okay, we found a box, a wood box, like about 12 by 14 by whatever, you know. And grandmother would put a layer of seaweed and push it down real hard on the four corners and keep pressing it down. And then take a few little twigs of cedar, and spread it around. And then get another layer of seaweed and push that down to all four corners. Maybe do four or five. And then put a heavy weight, like a flat rock, and let it set on the box for a couple of days, maybe. And by the time you took it out, it was already formed, like a square. Then she took it out and put it in the sun and let it dry till it got practically bone dry. And then when you wanted to have some during the winter or whatever, you just took a knife and carved a little bit off and came in a long strip and you could chew on it.
About how deep would you make it?
I'd say the cakes, they were about 3/4 of an inch to an inch thick. But the box would be like about so high.
Okay, because that's where you put the cedar between, so
yes.
It would only be, okay.
And the cedar flavored it a little bit, too.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever flavor it with other things?
We never thought of doing that. I tried this once in Ketchikan, because we'd gone to Grinnell and got seaweed in the 60s, and we had a lot of it, and I put it in cake pans. But mine didn't turn out that wonderful, but we ate it.
Did you ever flavor it with clam juice or anything like that?
No, I never have, but I can remember my grandmother taking the raw eggs from gumboots and squishing it up in water and making kind of a milk of it and then spreading it on the seaweed to give it extra flavor.
How do you say seaweed in Haida?
Seaweed, you say S-H-E-W, S-G underlined, which has an H sound, I-W, S-H-E-W. And water is
gumboot?
Gumboot is T. You put your tongue in the forward part of your mouth and go T.
Sockeye.
Sockeye is Kragan.
King salmon.
King salmon is Tawan. Halibut is Huck. Or there's another name for it. You can call a halibut whatever you want to call it, good or bad. But you must never do it to a salmon. It's taboo in the Haida culture. Humpy is I forgot the word already. But anyhow, koho is Thai. That's about the extent of my fish name.
Could you say something in
Haida? Oh, you want me to say something in Haida? Okay, yeah. I haven't seen this person for a long time, so I'd go up to her and I'd say, Ja, g'day, sun ding Haiden. And then I would say, Adat the wana ungung iskan di tlal hewangung. And I'll translate it now. Hello, my dear, how are you? I went berry picking. I went clam digging. And my husband is going fishing.
Very good. Thank you. We're going to change questions a little bit. Could you tell me who your brothers and sisters, the names of your brothers and sisters, kind of who your aunts and uncles and some of your cousins?
Well, today I only have one brother and one sister left. The rest have gone. There was Raymond Jones, Melinda Jones, Henry Jones, George Jones, Louise, Rosemond, Lear, which Haidas couldn't say R, so they called him Leah, Catherine Jones, Willard Jones, and myself. Of course, Willard's the youngest. And my uncle, I can only recall having one real true uncle, and he was Julius Frank. But we called my dad's cousin's uncle, like Wells Jones, Robert Jones, Healy Jones, and Brown Jones. And I don't recall any aunts, but Eliza was mom's first cousin, which is considered sisters, the Hideaway. So she really, we considered her an aunt. Eliza Bernard Young McAlpin was her name. Her Haida name was Kaeljus. And my mother's name was Tauhewat. And my father's name was Stast. There's a lot of Stast that came after him, so we've got two or three of them in the family today. Oh, and Raymond's Haida name was Hutzikakdas. I'm not sure what it means. Hoots could be raven or wolf. And I can't remember anybody else's names. Except mine is, I told you before, Oslav Gidauk.
Did you have any cousins?
Not any first cousins. Not one single first cousin. But second cousins we got by the dozens. See, mother's only brother did not have children. They adopted Wally Frank when he was first born. And my father, our father didn't have any brothers or sisters. So therefore, we don't have one single first cousin, but a lot of second cousins, like Caroline and Sheena and the Churchills up in Wrangell and many over in Heidelberg, Douglases, Skillies. That's all I can remember.
Were they considered, like, since they were the same clan, like our, were they considered like sisters? Like you used to, I remember you telling me that Betty and Dodo and everybody, they were really kind of like your sisters in some way. That was
yes.
Quite a word for that. There was no word for cousin, it was sister, right?
Okay, the way Eliza called my mother, older sister is Gwe. In fact, Caroline and her sisters only can remember her as Gwe, older sister, because that's what their mother called our mother. So it was not really, there's no word for cousin, it's like a sister or a brother.
So then who were they? Could you name, since there was no cousin, did you name who these sisters were?
I don't get you.
Well, you said that there was no name for cousin, that
oh.
All these people were your sister, your mother's sisters. Could you name them, those people?
Okay, that would be Eliza. She's the only one that I can think of right now. If there were any more, I can't recall.
Who were her children?
Eliza's children were Betty, Caroline, Roberta, Sheena, Evelyn. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they're all the same clan as?
Yes, Toslanus, Raven.
Okay. When you lived here as a child, did you go to school here in town or did you go to school someplace else?
Okay, I started school when I was like 6 or 7 years old in what they call Kassan Territorial School because it was still a territory. And I started in the new schoolhouse, which is where the present school is located now. But before then, there was what they called a red schoolhouse. And it was a two-story building located by where Peggy Young's house is now. And I went there for 8 years. And I got out of eighth grade. I went to Sheldon Jackson for 4 years and the Haskell Institute in Lawrence, Kansas for a two-year business course.
Could you tell me about any kind of experiences that you had when you were going to school here in Kassan? Good or bad?
It was fun going to school in a one schoolroom. You know, I'd get all my work done way ahead of time. Then I'd sit and listen and observe and learn from the older grades. That's why I'm so smart today. I mean, that's a joke. But it was fun. I enjoyed school. I really enjoyed school, except for arithmetic.
And about how many students were in school when you were in school?
Oh, I'd say 15 to 20.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you remember some of the names of the other students?
Yeah, most of them are gone now. There's Maylees, Harriet McAllister. I can't remember anymore. There's an old picture taken of the school by the Red Schoolhouse where Mrs. So-and-so was teaching. And it was like a public school. So therefore the people who migrated here from Kent Valley could also go to the school. I mean, it wasn't a BIA, which our school later became in the 40s. And that's where Minnie Stevens came and worked here and taught here for a number of years. But I didn't attend it. I think by that time Willard was in school and he went to the BRV Indian Affairs School.
Do you remember how many families used to live in Kassan?
Oh, there was a number of them. There was a family in every house, and there were a lot of houses.
I've got the picture here we'll look at later.
Yeah.
Do you remember who some of these people were?
Yeah, there was a Peel's family, there was a Baranovich family, there was a Jacob Thomas family, my grandmother's sister. There was a Williams family. There was Felix Young's family, Irving's. They had a house, they had a four-bedroom house. there was a Caucasian family that lived up in the woods by the name of Cole. There was a Griffin family that lived in a big house that later Pearl and Eddie Young lived in. There used to be quite a few people here. But they gradually moved away.
Do you remember why?
Well, lack of employment for one. Mm-hmm.
I mean, what did they do before that there was a lack of employment after? Where did
okay, they work? I can recall when this canning season started, my dad would immediately go to work as a carpenter down at the cannery. He'd get up and go to work every morning. And the cook was really nice to him. He'd be sending goodies home, like pastry and stuff, you know, and at Easter time, a bunch of colored eggs. I thought that was pretty nice. And there were mining camps around here too, you know, and prospectors out looking for gold, and eventually some of them settled here by the name of, well, maybe they weren't prospectors, I don't know, but they were always here. There's two fellows that lived up by what we call Stevens Ranch, Coleman and Paul Jordan, and then there was another old gentleman who lived up by the woods, by the Little Creek, what we call Little Creek. He later married one of Maggie Frank's mother, I believe. His name was Speck, S-P-E-T-C-H or something like that. It was pronounced entirely different than what it looked like. But anyhow, I got another cute story to tell if I got the time.
Sure.
Okay, there was a boat launching. The Souvenir, which was built by my dad and Robert Jones, his cousin. And it took a long time for them to get the boat down into the water, and boy, there was a big celebration afterwards, but I didn't realize this. My father didn't come home, and he 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 didn't. For all I knew, he didn't come home at all. But when I got up in the morning, there he was cooking breakfast as usual. But in the meantime, I kept asking Mom, when's Dad coming home? Where's Dad? She'd shake her head and say, I don't know. He'll come home. I must have asked her at least three or four times, and finally, when I went to bed, I forgot about it. Next morning, there he is, cooking breakfast. 30 years later, she tells me what happened. He and a bunch of other men who launched and built the boat went up to old Mr. Speck's house and drank home brew and had a big party. Men only.
Could you tell us some of your favorite memories that you have of Kasan when you were growing up?
Oh, yes. Mother had two large ice cream makers. I think one held a gallon and the other held two quarts. My Uncle Julius always had ice on his boat when he came in because he brought home fish. He'd go fishing up at Fairweather Grounds. They'd also bring back strawberries, wild strawberries. I can remember Raymond going down into the hatch and bringing a tray of these pale, pale strawberries, but they were delicious. And Mother would get busy and mix up whatever she had to do to make ice cream, and we'd get the ice off the boat. And everybody had to take their turn cranking it, and it took a good hour, you know. And then she'd take the dasher out, that middle part, and then she'd put it on a platter, and we could get to lick it with our fingers. And then she'd put the cover back on, and then she'd put a raw potato to cover that little hole where the dash top of the dasher was. 1 hour we had to wait till it set. That 1 hour seemed like a week. Oh, finally she'd open up and we all sit around and eat ice cream galore. It was wonderful. And another good thing I remember about living in Kasan when I was little, seems like my Uncle Julius always had money, which there was a scarcity of in our household. And he'd always bring fruit. I remember one time he bought me a new pair of shoes. I don't know how we figured the right size, but I was delirious with joy. And my grandfather spoiled me pretty bad because he said that I was a reincarnation of his daughter who died. And he'd give me candy, gum, fruit. We'd come from the store and he'd call me. He'd be standing out there on the road and he'd say, come and get it. And he'd bring me oranges and apples and candy, and Cracker Jack, stuff like that. It was pretty nice. And Christmas in Kasan was something else. In fact, I did a write-up about it in the Island News and it was published. It was called Christmas in Kasan in the 30s. We had a huge Christmas tree in the hall. Candle lit, real candles. And everybody got a present from the A and B and A and S. And bags of candy, with nuts and candy. Excuse me. And then this to me was so fascinating. They tied oranges and apples onto a dead alderwood tree on the branches, tied it on somehow. And a man, as we were leaving, a man would go up there and shake the tree. And all these oranges and apples would fall to the floor and we'd scurry for them. And that was pretty neat. That's one of my fond memories. I got lots more, but it might take all day. And you've got a 2:30 plane.
What you were mentioning about reincarnation, what do you know about that?
Okay, the Haidas firmly believe in reincarnation. You know, so there's some sense of Clankets to a lot of other native peoples. But my grandfather told me that when I was a very little girl, I said to him in Haida, when are you going to bring me my new shoes? I called him father in Haida, which is Hada. Hada, when are you going to bring me my new shoes? So instantly he felt that I was his daughter reincarnated.
How did a woman know that she might be having...
Oh, this is another thing. A woman was pregnant. And if she dreamt about a certain person more than once, her child was a reincarnation of this person she dreamt about. Or anybody else could have a dream when this woman was pregnant. And it usually worked out that way too. So I am a real firm believer in reincarnation.
How do you say that in Haida?
Hants. You're somebody's hants. Image, it means, literally.
During your lifetime, what kind of changes have you seen in Kasan?
Well, for one thing, the drastic change in the population, which is kind of sad because there's no employment here for people, and the boardwalks were something really super nice here. But we can't have oil deliveries or whatever with trucks rumbling on our little old boardwalk, so it's more practical to have what we call our road system now. And then the fact that there aren't any more stores here, and with the coming of TV and telephones and good water system, and so there's good and bad, you know, changes.
What kind of stores do they used to have here?
Okay, the biggest store was a company store, which is located by the cannery grounds, and they carried everything there. Work clothes, canned goods, dry goods, material fabrics for whatever, and but it was only open during the summer. It was closed during the winter. And then there was what we call Jack Nelson's store, which is located where Val's house is now, Val Braz. And he had the post office, he had two pool tables, dry goods, produce, candy. I got a story to tell about him too. His wife was from Australia, and she was here forever and never lost her accent. Jack was quite a guy. He liked to make his own home brew and invite friends and people down there to drink home brew with him. And when he'd had a few brews, he'd get very generous. Practically gave away the store. I can remember my sister Catherine and Laura, Raymond's wife, coming back with two big brown paper bags full of goodies. Goodies we call pineapples, corned beef, pig's feet, candy bars, pop. They were laughing and giggling all the way home with their bags full of goodies. So I said, well, what's so funny? She said, well, Jack got in a generous mood and gave us all this good stuff. That's the end of Jack's story.
Did you remember the cannery and what you used to do?
Oh, definitely. It was my first job in a cannery here to make money for school clothes and tuition and my fare up to Sitka. And it gave me a job and all the other young ladies around, like Caroline and Caroline Betty. In fact, my mother and my grandmother also worked in the cannery as slimers. You know, they got better pay. We worked on the patch table or the capping table or whatever you call it. And we piled cans. You pile them up in a big pile, and then when it came time to put the labels on it, you do the reverse. You put it in the machine, and the machine automatically gave it a label, and they were packed in boxes. But there was a lot of fish in those days. We worked and we worked and we worked and we worked for very little, but it was better than nothing. You know, it bought me my clothes and tuition and stuff like that.
So when did the cannery close, do you know?
Actually, it was open my growing up years, because Dad worked, you know, as a carpenter there. But then he'd go fishing in the summer, of course, during the sailing season. But something happened, the company went broke, it was called Northwest Fisheries. I remember that. And then Pacific American bought them out in about the 30s. And they reopened and put a two-line canning business there. And of course, we were happy, you know, we had jobs. And then it ran for a number of years, and then it closed again in the 40s. I don't know what happened, but they should have made money, because there was plenty of fish.
So when the cannery closed, that's when people started leaving town?
Yes, I believe so. And then different ones moved away to Heidelberg, like the Baranoviches moved to Heidelberg, and Sam Davis, our minister, after preaching here for 10 years at our Presbyterian church, he moved over and started preaching over there. And I think the Peels moved away too. Seems like they moved either to Saxman or Ketchikan. Didn't she say that in her talks? No.
Then when did you leave? And why did you leave Kasan?
Well, I went away to high school to Sheldon Jackson in late 30s. I graduated in 41. And dear Miss Whitmore persuaded me to go to Haskell. And she had plans for me, and I'm thankful she did. I got a $500 loan from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which paid my tuition for 2 years. Can you imagine that? Of course, I had to work half a day, too, like I did at Sheldon Jackson.
And did you ever come back as an adult?
I came back every summer and worked in the cannery, and then I went. After graduating from high school, I went to Haskell and came back, and then went back the second year and met Perry and got married. Met him in September and got married in December. He swept me off my feet.
So you met him in Kansas?
No, on the boat going down to Seattle.
Oh.
No, steamer. Prince George or Prince Rupert, on those Prince boats.
And where was he going?
He was going back down to Port Angeles, where he came from, and had worked up here on construction somewhere, Annette Island or somewhere.
Okay, so then after you married, did you come back and come to Kasan?
Yes, we came back in 1949 and stayed here until, let's see, we moved up to Hollis and built a little home up there. And then we moved the house over to Ketchikan, where we bought some property and lived in Ketchikan for, I'd say, about 10 years. And then when he got the bigger boat and started fishing down there, the first couple of years I just followed him. And then we decided it'd be nice if I went out with him, and which I did for 20 years. I fished with my husband.
Oh, goodness.
All I did was clean fish. I never landed one. Oh, I landed two. tuna, albacore tuna, but, you know, that was easy. Didn't have to club on the head and gaff them.
When did you guys decide to come back to Kasan and live?
Oh, it was like about 79 or 80. We were living down in Oregon in a beautiful furnished two-bedroom, three-bath, nice place, and we could have bought it for what it cost to build. And we didn't, luckily. But I said to Perry one day, what are we doing down all the way down here in Oregon, away from our friends and relatives? I said, let's go back to Alaska. So we started talking about it, thinking about it, planning, and then we decided we'd build a house down there and then move it up. This is a modular house, you know. And that was 1982. So we've been here going on 19 years for the third time.
Yeah, the second time was when you came back.
In 49.
Yeah, tell us about how you
came back. Okay, 19, Mother and Dad used to come down to Seattle every fall after the season was over and stay with us for about a month or 6 weeks or whatever. And they'd urge me, come back to Alaska, you folks aren't getting ahead down here, which we weren't. I was working, Perry's working, and you just can't make it in a big city unless you have a high salary, which we didn't have. So it was decided that we would come up here. So we stored our furniture, and I came up with the boys, and on June 25th, 1949, how well I remember that day. We got off in Ketchikan, and Chris, the oldest one, was stomping his foot on the boardwalks and saying, you told me there were no cars in Kasan. I said, this isn't Kasan, this is Ketchikan. Oh. So then we came over, and on the Invictus, no, it was the Uranus, and Perry stayed down and caught a ride back on the Invictus with Raymond because they had to work on their nets down there. But I got permission from my mother to fix up her mother's old house, and which we did. We put new shingles. Yeah, you want it on?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
No, just
do it. I was going to say it.
Just do it so we have it, yeah.
Okay, this is what I call Cajun fish soup. I take a can of sockeye. First I start with this potatoes and onions and carrots and give that a good boil with garlic and stewed tomatoes. It's better if you have fresh, but you can use canned. Then you add the fish and chunks and lots of water and salt and pepper and garlic powder and whatever, and just let it simmer a few minutes. It's wonderful. Oh yeah, Tabasco sauce, a little bit.
Do you put in Cajun seasoning too, or
well,
just?
Well, you have it, yeah. But all I've got is Tabasco.
Hmm.
It's wonderful.
Sounds delicious.
I learned this from Sam Douglas over in Heidelberg.
You should tell him about Charlie Wong crab.
Oh.
How about what do they call it when you do the heads with tomatoes?
Hawaiian.
Hawaiian style.
Yeah.
Can I have that? Anybody else have it?
That is so good, and Della's not in Anchorage anymore, and I'm going.
No, 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 that's the guy. Here's 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 chives. Oh, bay leaf.
Bay leaf.
A couple of bay leaves. You've got to have the bay leaf.
And onions, garlic, if you want it.
Celery.
Yeah. Anything.
Yeah.
Easy.
And that's the head?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the head. It's wonderful.
Hawaiian style. Yeah.
Blackstead taught us that.
Then where do you put the rice? Is that in your bowl?
On the bottom.
When you're serving it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Napkin.
Which means
tastes good.
And Simpson.
Jamaican.
Jamaican.
Is it? No, Jamaican.
That is a sing-dong down on that. And Charlie Wong crab.
Oh, that's easy.
That's the best. That's so good.
Oh,
go
Charlie
ahead.
Wong crab? Okay.
I'll say it again.
Charlie Wong crab. I gave it the name of Charlie Wong crab because he taught us. Preferably a live crab. But you got to take that little star because it's poisonous in the lungs. And you break it and kind of break it up so it's easy to eat. You put that in a pan of onion and bacon and soy sauce and the mustard from the crab.
Mustard from the crab.
Ooh, with a little water.
Mm.
And then
ginger
and garlic.
And then you steam it.
For two, you put in about a thumb of ginger. Grated
out of this world.
Oh, I didn't know about the ginger.
Why do you call it Charlie Wong crab?
He showed us how to do it.
Who's Charlie
Wong?
Charlie Wong is the old Chadwick who moved up here from San Francisco to get away from the Tong.
What's the Tong?
Like
a mafia type.
I
got one opened already.
Well, I wanted to make chowder and sandwiches.
Yeah.
What?
Chowder and sandwiches.
Oh.
Is this year's fish?
Yeah, you have to cook it a little longer.
Okay.
Why don't you open one that doesn't have to be fried? It takes too long to thaw.
I didn't know where that recipe for
yeah.
that crab came from.
And every time we eat it, your mom always says, "Thank you, Charlie Wong."
Thank you, Charlie.
His dad made it a couple of years ago, and he says, "Well, I'm going to crack up all the crab, and we're going to crack the shells, and we're going to put it back in, and we're going to do this stuff to it." And I'm thinking, "You're ruining perfectly good crab." I rolled my eyes at him. He's going, "Oh, no. We're going to do this,
believe me.
Period, end of discussion." And so we did, and I'm in there doing this thing, going, "All right, we'll do this." Oh, good.
You don't
yes.
have to have it. It can be cooked, too.
Yep.
In fact, I've never ever had one done live.
No,
yeah,
we've only had
yeah.
it cooked, crab steamed already, then redone.
Chris and I tried to make it once, and we didn't really have the recipe, and we didn't put the mustard in.
You've got to have the mustard.
And it was just bland.
Bland.
Yeah.
So you have to take
the
mustard.
Crab's still in the shell.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Guys,
you're
done, huh?
No,
almost. We just took a recipe break. We wanted to get Mom's recipes on tape. We're almost here. We're getting right
I
down.
Got
hey.
Are you guys?
There's a paint my lipstick. What? Good looking.
Are you guys starting?
Well, we had her. She said, as she was.
Chanel Louis was a boat builder. I know that. Would you tell me about. How did he learn to build boats, Chanel?
There was an article in the Ketchikan Chronicle or Daily News about Dad and how he started to learn how to build boats. He sent for a book of instructions, I guess, and it was like a do-it-yourself. You know, if you've got the talent, you just have to have somebody show you. And he started building boats in his very early years. Big boats, little boats, skiffs. He built the Uranus, the Invictus, the Luann, the Review, he helped with the Souvenir, those are bigger same boats, and a number of smaller trolling boats and many, many, many skiffs. The last boat that he built for himself, it took him like 20 years. He started it and then he'd stop because they were building another bigger boat. In his spare time, he finished what he called a Malute, It was a double ender. I don't remember how long it was, but it had a little engine in it, and he ran to and from Ketchikan frequently. In fact, the last time he used it was the year Mom died, which was 1958. And I can recall that we all came back from Ketchikan with Mom's remains on the deck of the Invictus. And Dad insisted that he had to go by himself on Malut, which he did. Mm-hmm. And then later on, or prior to this, he came down to Seattle in 1949 because he had something wrong with his ears. One ear was really bad, so he went to the clinic at the Swedish hospital in Seattle and took radiation treatments for a long period of time. I believe it was cancer of the ear. But they cured it, but in the process he became more deaf than he was already. So he always had to use a hearing aid. But it took a long time for him to, he had to stay down in Seattle for a number of months. And he got bored, of course. And Perry was home on one of his trips from the Merchant Marine, and he says, "Hey, Louie, how about you building me a little skiff in the basement?" We had a full basement in this duplex we lived in on West Nickerson Street. And so the skiff grew and grew and grew, and by the time they got done making plans, it was maybe 15 feet. It had a part of a cabin on it, and they named it the Judy. But it was wonderful therapy, and I got many thanks from my brothers for Perry suggesting that Dad build a boat, because it was a wonderful thing for him to do while he was recovering from his radiation and having to stay down there for checkups. But they left in April, and they came up on one of those big, beautiful princess or prince boats, and Mom was worried about the number of pieces of silverware that was going to be on the table for her. And she said, "I'm not sure that I'll use the right one." I said, "Well, just work from the outside in." And they were okay, I guess, but Dad was rather perturbed with Mom, because she always had to have these flowers she had to be bringing home to Alaska. He said, "Every time we travel, you always have a shopping bag full of plants." She brought a lilac bush home. And you know, the strange part of it was, it didn't bloom until the year she passed away, 1958. It took that long for the lilac to bloom. But the boat we sold for very little money, I can't remember how much, but Mother and Dad were so happy when we got rid of it. They were afraid that we were going to go out into Puget Sound and get caught in a storm or whatever.
How'd they get the boat out of the garage?
Oh, that was another story. This garage had this duplex we were in had cement flooring in the basement, and then a siding. So Perry got smart and cut enough of the siding off to pull the boat out of the garage and up to about 10 steps up to the main floor. That was sort of scary to me.
I remember you telling me that Nana used to tell stories to you at night before you went to sleep, Raven stories or something. Tell me about that.
Oh, I don't remember the stories, but you remember what they call a Scheherazade, how she told those stories every night to keep the men away from her? Scheherazade, I guess it was called. But this was called Tietz Konani. It was a story about the raven who changed himself into many different things to finally reach his destination, but she'd tell us every night and almost put us asleep, and then we'd get a word that we didn't understand and we'd ask Willard and he'd transcribe it or translate it for us, because he knew the words better than we did at that time, and he was only like about 5 years old.
So she told those in Haida to you
every
night?
Yes, yes. Every night.
Do you remember stories Chennai used to tell when he came to live with us?
Yes, but they've kind of forgotten my mind. I think Della remembers them a lot better than I do, because, no, I don't. Mm-hmm. I heard so many of them, especially from my Chennai Paddy. that I can't even begin to recall even one.
I know you love to sing. What are some Haida songs that stick in your mind just off the top of your head, a beat or a rhythm?
Well, I really don't know the whole song, but there's one that goes, Sinyat Edu Di Sakingang Kilaskudung Waskananu. That's a very common song. There's many different interpretations. Then there's another one goes, it's called a drinking song. Awam Khutlai Adi Gulagandanu Wanwas. That's it, that's all I know. But I'm going to get the words and music to it somehow. The second song is called a drinking song because it's a story about these fellows who are having a few drinks together and enjoying their, you know, men get together. And all of a sudden this warship came in, and he didn't know which side he should go for. I will try to learn the song. Mm-hmm. My friend over in Craig knows it completely, and she knows the story it tells.
Who's that, your friend?
Florence Melky. She's a Kogo.
Ah. No. So it's he was the warship, and he didn't know which side to take.
Side? His girlfriend's side, who was one tribe, and he was of another tribe, but he didn't know which side to fight for.
Oh.
Wanwas means warship.
Mm. Not war canoe?
Well, warship canoe or whatever they were using.
Okay. I'm going to ask you a couple of little tough questions. Not too tough. As we've been trying to learn more about our traditions and our culture, what do you think we should be teaching our children or our grandchildren?
I think that you should tell your children and grandchildren about the Alaska Native way of telling stories, tradition, culture should be handed down. And I think that all the younger people, the younger generation today, should show more respect for elders. We were taught that from day one. You do not talk back, you do not sass, you don't argue, you just do what your elders expect you to do.
Okay. And what would you say that was one of the more important things that you want us to pass on, or is there something else that you would want us to pass on? Like you said, you think it was important to talk about respect for elders. Is there something else that you would like?
Well, that just about covers it. I mean, respect for the environment.
Okay.
You know, don't trash anything. Don't waste anything like fish, seaweed, all the natural foods. No waste. And never, never sass a salmon. You can call a halibut anything you want to, but don't do it to salmon. It is taboo.
Do you know why we can do a halibut but nothing else?
I've never heard that one, but I follow it to the letter.
How about our foods, and is it important to learn how to make the different kinds of foods?
Oh, yes, I think it's very important, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that when our great-great-grandchildren go up there will be some of these things still around, like salmon and venison, stuff like that.
Is there anything you'd like to ask?
Last question about important to pass on. That's the one you asked. So
is there anything that you would like to add that we've not asked, that we forgot to ask?
Well, I'll think about that for a minute.
Okay.
Well, I don't ever want to see Kasan turned into a city or a metropolis. I hope we can always keep it small towny.
What's the best thing about living here that kind of stuck with
Oh,
you?
The best thing about living in Kasan is the peace and tranquility and the beautiful scenery. No loud jets flying over, no loud trucks rumbling by, no sirens, no fire alarms, no... We don't have any of that. We love it here. Of course, it gets kind of boring in the winter. When nobody comes to visit, they all come in the summer. Please think about us in the winter.
Did you have something, Della, that you wanted to ask Mom or have on the record?
Do you remember when they rebuilt the Sunny Hat house and built the totem park?
Oh, yes.
CCC, yeah.
Are we taping?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, it was like in the mid-30s. Under the CCC plan, money was made available for any person who wanted to work to restore the totem poles and the totem house. So the pay wasn't good, but it was income. All my brothers and my dad worked, and it was about the time I started going to Sheldon Jackson. Yeah, and they did a fine job, and there was an old gentleman here by the name of Pete Jones, Annabelle's father, who was a cousin of my dad. I remember this because it's always a big thing to put children to work here, a youth employment program by Tlingit Haida. Pete Jones would take it upon himself to go both sides of the path, all the way up to Sunny Hat, and cut brush. And it always looked neat. Never had to worry about overgrowing weeds. But that's just something he did himself on his own and didn't get paid for it. He did it because he loved Kasan.
People used to clean up the cemetery too, didn't they?
Yes, every year people went up there and spent the whole day and took a lunch, and nobody got paid. Everybody took care of their own. You know, we called it Memorial Day. I don't know what they call it now. Mm-hmm. I guess it's still called Memorial Day. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking one other thing about Gagit. What can you tell us about Gagit?
Gagit is a boogeyman that scares all young people into coming home before it gets dark.
What is Gagit, though?
Gagit is supposed to be a half man and half animal. He got up in the water and got so cold he turned into an animal. And therefore he could survive in any kind of weather. I'm sure it's all myth.
So what would he do that was scary for children?
Just make you scared so you'll go home.
Did it work?
Worked for me. The Tlingits call it Kushtika.
Was there like a saga or like a medicine man?
Haga. He was a medicine man. He felt things and saw things and predicted things. He was a special person who had these powers to foresee events. That's about as much as I know of it. But there was an expression amongst the Haida, if somebody made a prediction just out of the blue, they'd say, Hasagagun. You know, he's a Haga person because he made this prediction that came true, but that doesn't mean he really was, but it was a way of expressing themselves about this person who could foresee things.
When you were growing up, did you know, was there a specific person who was that, or a person who used Devil's Club or any kind of herbs like that to do things? Or was that already kind of a gone?
It was sort of gone when I was growing up, but I purposely didn't try to learn about it. It was something that I just refused to pass down to my children. Kind of scary. And I didn't want them to know about it. Furthermore, I just wiped it out of my mind. I'm not spooky. I'm trying not to be spooky. You know what I'm saying? I just didn't feel that it was proper that we should hand things like this down to our children.
I remember you telling me that you shouldn't say something bad about somebody or would come back to you, and that's the way the Haida's doing.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about that a little bit.
Okay, it was taboo to say anything bad about anybody because it could happen to you if you made fun of somebody or said bad things about them behind their back. It was just a way of teaching people to be nice, I guess. You know, just don't say anything bad about anyone because it'll happen to you.
Mm-hmm. How do you say respect in Haida?
Yapet. Lal yapet.
That's high class.
High class. It also means respect. Lal yapet. He thinks highly of you, mm-hmm. or she thinks highly of him, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Isn't there like yakdang?
Yakdang. I can't remember what that means.
Are we done?
I can't think of anything.
I want to thank you very, very much, Helper, for giving information, sharing your time with us. It's been very enjoyable.
Oh, Lagen. I enjoyed it. Lagen.
Again.
How long?
What does that mean?
Tasty.
Tasty. Is it tasty?
Did you use an electric grinder? Mm-mm. All by hand?
All by hand.
I'm going to hide this. I'm get a taste of it. Crunchy. Sun-dried.
Partially sun-dried. Partly sun-dried and then... Because we had 3 days of sunny weather, and then it started raining on us. So we had to bring it in.
That was from...